Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
What motivation and what grit, because yeah, what you're describing is a really tough go.
No fancy lunches or dinners or entertainment or any of that, no.
Wow. So what really kept you going? Did you believe so deeply in the fact that it's the right thing for you to do?
Well, what kept me going? I wanted to make it work. I didn't want to fail. I don't know what kept me going. And at the end of that first year where we made a small profit, I thought, this is a start. I can do this. You know, because I was scared to death. Yeah. I didn't know anything about wine. I'd go to these technical seminars and ask stupid questions everybody else knew the answers to, right? But I was trying to learn, and I did what I could do, that's all.
Did you make your own wine?
I wasn't very good. Here's what we did. Mondavi, I have to be careful what I say here.
Mondavi
had some problems in 93, 94, maybe 95. And so he was selling some bulk wine. So I went with my Volkswagen van with the bed and back, and I had three American, I couldn't even afford French oak. And the cellar workers were snickering at me, and they filled up the three barrels, and I made four trips. So I bought 600 gallons, and we went home. I have my great-grandfather's old corker, and I rented the labeler from the complete winemaker in St. Helena, and I sat there filling bottles, and we labeled everything by hand and corked it one at a time. And so what we did, we had wine for sale the day we opened. And concurrently, I'd made wine in the fall. Again, not very good. So I was a winemaker until about 81. I got better, and I got advice, but I wasn't. Some of the latter vineyards is okay. And now we have a really good winemaker, Brooks Painter. But when we opened, I opened March 4th, 1976, I remember clearly, and my Finnish wife kept me, yeah, you're going to go broke, you know, get a steady job, you know, what are you doing? In 9 hours, we did $141 gross, and only because the banker came by, I don't know why he came by, they wouldn't lend me any money, a few neighbors, and they bought a bottle, and of course they never came back, right? And then the second day, we did something like $47 in 9 hours, and my wife, I told you we were going to go broke, you know, so it was scary in the beginning, so I had wine for sale, I had the deli, I had the picnic, you know, the one picnic table. And I'd put my dad out there. He'd like to read philosophy, so I'd give him a glass of wine and some bread and cheese. And he was my shill to try to attract. You know, people like to go where there's action, right? And later on, a few years later, we'd park all our cars in the front where people would see them. And then when it got busy, we'd move all the cars in back to create parking spaces. And then when it was kind of a drizzly day, I'd give people a bottle of wine, but you got to sit there for a half hour. We'll give you some cardboard. You know, because all these little common sense things, just to create action to bring people in. And you know, for the most part, it worked. So
I just want to point something out. I can't remember what I spent yesterday at a grocery store. You have a remarkable memory for numbers. Is it just something that is one of your gifts? I mean, you remember what you sold the first day you opened. How is that possible?
Well, good possibility is because I've related the story more than once. So that's part of it. But I am pretty good at numbers. Like, I can remember a lot of phone numbers. 340-something. No, you can't remember. But 3403 or something like that. Wow. And I only did it once. Is that right?
It's 7-7-403-2-7-6, I think.
Okay. Anyway, I only called her once or twice last year.
You have very good visual memory.
Yeah, I'm okay with numbers, I guess.
So you were saying you obviously deployed every possible trick, ingenuity galore here to make sure that your baby got off the ground, and you had enough faith in yourself, and especially when your partner is worried and is saying, hey, you know, we may not make it. Again, you are very good under pressure because a lot of people wouldn't have had the stamina. When did that shift occur, when you knew you weren't just going to make it, that this is it and you're going to thrive?
When I knew that I was going to succeed.
Yeah, so back, you started the winery, and then at some point it became, you know, the momentum started to build, right?
Yeah, I don't know exactly when that was, but probably after 5, 6, 7 years, profits kept getting bigger. I mean, they got bigger every year for years. And then we didn't distribute any profit because I wanted to put all the money back into the winery.
Yeah.
To buy equipment, to buy a forklift, yeah, which we never had, a cash register, all this stuff. So for years and years, we never had a distribution. So somewhere around there, I don't know exactly.
So you mentioned your family picnics when you were growing up, and then, you know, your winery offered, at what point did it offer the option of food and wine?
From day one.
So is that where it came from?
Yeah, I think so. You know, one, living in Europe.
Yeah.
Two, a lot of my Italian relatives, you know, they either in the backyard or wherever, they'd, yes, have this, you know, tables laden with food and wine.
Yes.
And,
yes,
and I want to do something different. You know, you went to Barrett, you went to another winery, and they'd say, keep off the lawn, right? And you go to certain wineries, and they weren't really making an effort to sell you the wine as much as they were trying to make a good impression. So when you went back to Illinois or New Jersey, you considered buying their wine in the wine shop.
Yeah.
Well, me, if I didn't sell the wine then, I blew it. And it wasn't the customer's fault, it was my fault, because I didn't come up with something, a reason why, one, to bring them in, and two, to sell them a bottle of wine. And that's part of the reason why Satui has about 40 different wines in different styles, at different price points, and different flavors, because I want everybody who comes in that door to find a wine at a price and a style that they want.
How about that? So your vision clearly had proven prophetic.
I say mean, it again?
You were the pioneer of food and wine.
I think
culture,
for
you know,
sure, we were the pioneer in selling direct.
Yeah.
No, nobody was doing that. Well, I think Hanzel over in Sonoma was doing it, maybe a couple small wineries.
Yeah.
But nobody did it in the scale we did it. Yeah.
So you noticed that it stuck, that people really loved coming to this location and having wine and food together and, you know, being social, because you had outdoor option where people could really, you know, have fun and enjoy themselves and bring families.
Yeah.
That must be the foundational pieces of how your business, you know, really
took off. And it, you know, it didn't go like this, but it grew fairly rapidly and you know, Satui is selling, I don't know, 60,000-65,000 cases a year direct out of the winery. I mean, I don't know that anybody does anything like that. And the castle's pretty close to it.
So as your business grew, that model, direct to consumer, you know, again, has proven to be the model to follow. But it's not common. You know, it's, you know, most wineries these days are distributed. I don't know very many that are not. I mean, there are, but, you know, they still want to have presence in restaurants and, you know, anyway. You, from the beginning, had this vision of direct-to-consumer before that was a popular term. Why?
Why? Trying to be different. You know, I figured if I can get them in the door, first of all, we were small.
Yeah.
So I didn't have a lot of wine to sell in the beginning. Like from Mondavi, I had 600 gallons and while we were making our own. And so we didn't have a lot of wine, so why sell it at half off to some distributor? back east, you know, and then you have to send your, well, that, I was a winemaker, you know, send your principals and give them samples and on and on and on, and maybe they don't even pay you. And so I, and I heard the horror stories from some of the other wineries that did sell through the channels.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to do it. And as a small niche winery, I was able to sell everything direct.
And that gave you encouragement to continue along those lines, you know, moving forward.
Yeah, so we're never going to change, no.
Yeah. So as Visa Tui became really, really successful, at what point did you decide to purchase property in Calistoga?
Okay, this is a great story. It's true. I did not want a second winery. Okay. Satui was doing great. I was about 50 odd years old. I was going to semi-retire, live in Europe, Italy, and half a year or so, and Satui, you know, run Satui the other half. This house and this property was for sale, and it was for sale for a period of years. The price was too high. Originally, the owner, who was Andre Boss, wanted $10 million. You know, I didn't have $10 million. And then after a year or two, he dropped it to 7.5. And then after another couple of years, he dropped it to 4.5. And a friend of mine, I didn't even know that. And a friend of mine came and told me, did you notice that Boss dropped the price to 4.5? So I got interested. So I negotiated a lot with Boss for about 3 months. And I kept telling him I'm looking at other properties, which I was, but I wanted this property. And he kept telling me he had other buyers, and I thought he was lying. And and then I almost had him to sign, but I tried to get all the antiques. He had a lot of this. I had to pay extra for it, but this is made for the house out of Italy. And some of the furniture here, but I had to pay extra for it. Anyway, I tried to get the antiques too, and he started swearing at me, and he stalked out. And then I didn't see him for a while. And then a realtor told me, Boss sold the property. I thought, oh, Christ. Mm-hmm. I thought I should have offered $100,000 more. You know, I'm stupid. You know, I really wanted the property. Not to build a winery, because it has a stream, it has a little lake, it's 171 acres, it has history. The Blue House is one of the oldest houses in Napa County, settled by Colonel William Nash, 1847. Who had one of the first vineyards. He was reputed to bring the first fruit trees to California. I don't believe that's true. I think the missionaries did that. But and he was famous because his grandfather, great-grandfather, was a Revolutionary War hero, and they named Nashville, Tennessee, after his family. So it was all this stuff mesmerized me. And so Nash sold the property, and I knew he had a loan with the Bank of San Francisco. It's now defunct, and for $1.5 million, and they kept threatening to call the loan. So about 3 weeks later, he calls me up on a Friday night, and he says, do you still want to buy the property? Uh-huh. And I was getting over my sadness then, and I thought, yeah. And I don't care. I'll tell you what I paid for. I said, but I'm only going to pay you what I offered you last time, $3 million. And he started swearing on the phone. And I said, but why? I thought it was sold. And he said, yeah, but one guy, I have to have the money to the bank by Monday morning, or they're going to take this property. Because I guess the bank got tired of him, you know, postponing everything. And so, I'm always a saver. You know, when I was a kid, I was 12 years old, I had $2,000 in the bank, you know, because I always saved my money. So, I had not the whole price, but I had enough to pay off his loan. Yeah. And then he apparently had a backup offer, and the guy couldn't come up with a deposit by Monday morning enough to satisfy his loan. So I got the property. And then I found out months later from a realtor that $100,000 more, I wouldn't have bought the property. The guy that had bought it and couldn't get back from Europe had offered $850,000 more, and the other guy $450,000. So I never would have got. So in a way, I was really lucky to get the property. And so then I thought, well, there's Nash's old vineyards here on the property, and you know, they're in disrepair. So I'll plant new vineyard and I'll sell the grapes to Satui. Again, I didn't want a winery. But one factor I left out, along with the house, oh, they had the first schoolhouse in Napa County too, where the stone building is by the highway there.
Okay.
I didn't tear it down. It was torn down way before me. And this permit that came with the property, 250,000 gallons of wine production, that the former owner took years, boss took years to get.
Yeah.
And 130,000 square foot winery. And the last public tour and tasting permit ever given in Napa County was late 88 or early 89. And so, which you probably know, public tour and tasting means you can go in without a reservation.
Yep.
Where ever since the WDO, the Winery Definition Ordinance, 1990, you're supposed to reserve a space. Most wineries cheat, but if the county ever wanted to crack down, they could. So so I got this great permit. I gave it zero value because I just wanted the house and the property. And then I started thinking a little bit, okay, I'll plant grapes, sell them to do it. And I thought, oh, I really love medieval architecture. I'll build a small building on the property. And I don't even think at that time, I'm trying to be honest, I even thought of a winery. I just thought, I want to build a building. And I'd already bought an old monastery in Italy, and now I own three properties in Italy, one in France. I have this disease. I love architecture. It's a weakness. And anyway, it's incurable. So so then the small building eventually morphed into about 150,000 square feet. And I had so much fun building that. I mean, I loved it. The county gave me a lot of problems, but I had a lot of fun. And I was so afraid of getting it wrong and being laughed at. I think fear of failure is a great incentive to to try to do a good job. So I had nightmares over that project. And then the first day we opened, I wondered, will anybody come, or have I made a total fool out of myself? And I had pretty much a sleepless night, and then I went on the drawbridge and waited. And people trickled in, but it wasn't like a mass of people the first day. But it kept building. And I think Castelli Amorosa and Vistatui Winery are the most visited wineries in California now. They each see about 400,000 people a year. So.
Absolutely. So how long did it take to complete the castle?
It took almost 15 years. Finally, towards the end, I didn't get... The builder was really intelligent, really good, but he was a cranky son of a gun. His wife said he suffered from depression, and we didn't get along. Mm. But I just swallowed my pride. I put up with him for 10 years or more, because he was really good, and I just wanted to get the project done. So,
right.
And sometimes I didn't even want to go up there because he'd start yelling at me for, what did I do now? And, you know, I was his boss, but he'd be yelling at me. So, and then I found somebody else over in Italy, and I had him work under the Henri guy just to see if he could do it.
Yeah.
And he was able to do it. And now we're still good friends. I just communicated with him today. And then the first guy, he never wanted to have more than 15 people on the job. I think he wanted to retire on me.
Yeah.
And he was getting 15 weeks vacation because he had a farm in Italy. And, you know, so I had to put up a lot of stuff and well paid. But I wanted to. And nobody, I tried American contractors. They couldn't get it at all. They didn't understand it. They, you know, they were scared of it. So the first guy was good, but the second guy, then he put on, in the last 3 years, 63 people. So he was running a lot of different things at the same time, and he finished the job and did it great. In fact, he did the stone building over here, and which I think is really beautiful. So so I was fortunate. I love medieval architecture so much. I used to get on my motorcycle in Italy or in my car, and I'd often get up before dawn, come back after dark, and almost nobody would ever go with me twice. And I'd get a backpack, I'd have a hammer, a flashlight, a sketch pad, and a measuring tape. And I'd wander into these old farmhouses or castles or things that were abandoned, or if they weren't, I mean, they were abandoned. If they were locked up, that's why the hammer. I'd never steal anything. I'd always put it back, or I'd find an open window. Or if I couldn't do that, I would dress up and pretend I had money and a suit and tie, and I'd go to a realtor, and I'd say, I want to buy a castle. And what do you have to show me? So I got to see a lot of places one way or another. But in doing all that, I studied it. I drew drawings. I took thousands of photos of railings, chimneys, ceilings, stone walls, everything. I loved it. And so I had a good conceptual thing of what to do. And all these photos of different rooms. And then I found out where to get materials. You know, over a period of years, you do stuff and you hear people and so forth, or you know, where to get a good blacksmith or so forth. And so I was already set to do this project by the time I decided to do it, because I had all the resources already. And we have 107 rooms up here, no two rooms alike. It's all the ideas I saw over a period of years. So anyway, so then I decided to build a small building. It became the big building. And I wanted to make Italian-style wines, which is basically what we do. Mm-hmm. It's also Chardonnay, Merlot, and Cabernet. But so that's what we're doing, and selling it all direct.
An extraordinary drive and stamina. Mm-hmm. You had the materials, you had the background, you had incredible passion from what you're describing. But still, having it come to fruition, such a massive architectural undertaking, I can't imagine what your sleepless nights were like, because you're doing something that's completely unprecedented.
I almost quit a few times. The county gave me such a bad time, and the first guy, you know, I got tired of him yelling at me, but I didn't. Somehow I stuck it out. And I know architects come up here and contractors, and they can't even wrap their mind around it. They just say, you know, how did you do this, you know? And so,
this is a composition of all your observations, right? It's not exactly modeled after.
No, it's not. You know, some people think I took one castle and either brought it over or brought the ideas over. It's everything I saw over a period of years, also from France as well. In Beaune, there's some underground cellars, and some of I spent all day in this, I can't remember the name of it, under the walls of Beaune, there's from 13th, 14th century, these cellars, and they closed for lunch, and I came back in the afternoon, I was photographing, measuring, and on my knees, and I had people going by, and the watchman kept going by. Finally, late afternoon, he grabbed me from back, and he threw me out, and I was embarrassed, and I said, you son of a bitch. I said, I'm going to build something I was just talking. I had no idea what I was going to do. I'm going to build something like this, and I'm going to come back and show you the photographs. And I guess I hurt my feelings. And so I actually did come back about 15, 20 years later. But he was dead, so then I brought some photos with me, too.
But it's instructive that you wanted to fulfill your promise. Was there ever a moment where you wanted to stop, where you just were so discouraged?
Yeah, there were moments. The county gave me a really tough time. In fact, when we'd finished the building, they weren't happy with the pavement. And I know it was kind of rough. I was building a medieval structure. So they made me redo most of the pavement, brick pavement. It took, I can't remember, two and a half years. it cost a lot of money to redo all the pavement. And the kitchen, because it was such a long project, the codes changed twice. So I started building a kitchen, and then, I don't know why we didn't finish it, but codes changed, so we had to change the kitchen. And then a couple of years later, the codes changed again. We had to change the kitchen again. I don't think we had to change it totally, but partially we had to change it.
I know the level of detail is mind-boggling.
You know, I kept going back to Europe. I kept looking at it. And at night, I'd go over the plans and refine them. And partly, again, it's fear of failure, fear of getting laughed at, and wanting to do it right, to get it right. And, I try to, and people don't see all the detail I put in. For instance, outside the Great Hall, there's seven, I don't know what you call them in English, bifore in Italian, double windows with a central column. Each one is hand-carved individually, because that's the way it would have been done. It would have been done all alike, you know, each one similar to the next one. And there's doors that are bricked up because a different owner came, and his wife said, I don't want the entrance here, I want it over here, whatever happened. And the walls fell down and they were rebuilt. And so I tried to show different styles of architecture, like 9th to maybe 14th century would have been more square stone, and then starting 15th, 16th century, more a rubble look. I tried to show that the castle, maybe it started with one tower and then it evolved over time and got bigger and enlarged and changed. And this quarry was exhausted, so they had to get stone from another quarry, which we have. And I even bought an old winery, Seventh-day Adventist, in one on his property up in, by Angwin. And it took us 3 months to tear it down, 10 guys. And then we hauled all the stone over here, and we marked all the arches, and we incorporated a lot of the arches and door surrounds in this winery. So, but it was a different type of stone, a sandstone, where most of the stone was a basalt, a real hard stone mm-hmm. to chip.
There's a piece that you left exposed for people to see the detail inside, right?
Yeah, and I have to say, without Mexicans who were really willing to work hard, I never could have built this. We had as many as 17 Mexicans chipping and squaring stone day after day, year after year, in the heat, the cold, and without them, I couldn't have done it. So I really need gratitude to them.
What was the best comment you've ever heard about your creation?
I don't know, what I've heard often is great vision. I don't know if I had a great vision. I just, something inside me made me want to do it. I don't know. But that's the comment I've heard a lot.
Your tenacity is really awe-inspiring. So there you were building this extraordinary structure, again, unprecedented, large scale. How did the wine make its way, you know, how did you create and visualize what would populate the castle?
Okay, I think in the beginning, I just wanted to build a small structure. And then, again, it took almost 15 years. So then I started thinking, well, I'd really like to make Italian style wines and make wines that are different from Visatui, the other winery. And so, we replanted this vineyard here, and now we own 84 acres, soon to be 126 acres of vineyard. We have three in Anderson Valley, one over by Sebastopol, and two here in the Napa Valley. And I wanted to differentiate ourselves from Visatui, and just a different concept and medievalize the extent. Like, I wanted people to come in and just go, wow, you know, and be so awestruck that they couldn't help but buy a bottle of wine. That by the time they finished seeing the place, I mean, how could they resist? And what I was surprised, I knew kids would like it, but I listen to people often, and it's amazing how many older people really enjoy the place and act like kids almost, that they get so excited about the place.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.